We're beginning our classes on Daniel, which will lead us into the book of Esther. And right now, as an intro to Daniel, which is an intro to Esther, we will begin with the book of Kings, what they call the 24th chapter. But we need to introduce Kings 24, which is the introduction to Daniel, which is the introduction to Esther. You guys brought your sense of humor along?
Yeah.
Humor. Okay, so let's begin. Let's begin with creation, okay? We have a world. 7 days, yeah? We have a world. And then we have an Adam and an Eve. 10 generations later, we have Noah, we have the flood. 10 generations later, we have
Avram.
What year is Avram born?
1948.
1948 years from creation. Avraham has many children. His prime son is Yitzchak, Ki v'Yitzchak yikarei lecha zara. Among his children are the Yishmaelim, the Midianites, right? Many different tribes come from Avram. Eifa v'Eifer v'Chanoch v'Avidah v'Elda'a, all kinds of different tribes. And his son, Yitzchak, has two children, as we well know, Yaakov and Esav. From Esav descends Amalek. Esav commits adultery with his daughter-in-law, Eliphaz's wife, and they have a child named Amalek. So Amalek is like a mamzer, okay? Eliphaz's son or Esav's son, whatever. And from Yaakov, we have the 12 tribes, which descend to Egypt. And in the year 2448, exit Egypt, receive the Torah. 40 years later, enter the land of Israel in the year 2488, under the leadership of Yoshua ben Nun. We conquer the land of Israel for 7 years, divide it for another 7 years, and after those 14 years, Yoshua passes away. We are under the leadership of the judges. We enter the period of the Shoftim, the judges. We have a judge from almost each tribe. The judges are not kings. They are leaders. They guide us to war. They lead us morally, ethically, halachically. But they're not kings. A judge's son does not become a judge. And the final judge we have is the prophet Shmuel Samuel, who anoints our first king, Saul. King Saul sins and loses his rights to the throne, and then King David takes the throne. King David takes the throne and wins the wars on behalf of Israel, conquers our enemies. He leads the war against Amalek. Saul did not do a good job against Amalek, although Saul started the battle, but he left remnants behind. When Saul fought Amalek, he left the king Agog alive. That night, Agog is intimate with the maid of his cell. She becomes pregnant, and from that we have a continuation of Amalek, which will ultimately bring about Haman, right? The great antagonist of our Megillah. So Saul loses his throne. He's killed at war together with his children on Mount Gilboa. And David is anointed as king at the ripe old age of 30. He becomes king. He is king for 40 years and dies at the age of 70. When Adam looks into the future and sees all future generations, he sees an amazing scion that's going to die his first year. Die right after death. His name is Elchanan, otherwise known as David. King David was not supposed to live much of a life. And Adam says to God, I'll give him 70 years off my life. That's why Adam lived 930 years. He was supposed to live 1,000 years. God says, "Biyom achol chamimenu motamut." On the day you eat from the forbidden fruit, you will die. We say in Psalms, a day in God's figuring is 1,000 years. So Adam was granted a day of God's, right? On the day you eat from him, in that 1,000 years, you will die. So why did he die at age 930? So we have a tradition that he gave 70 years of his life to David. So David becomes king, and he says the average lifespan is 70 years. As we say in Psalms on Shabbos, Yemei Shnotenu Shivim Shana. David has a son named Shlomo, Solomon. Solomon builds the temple. King Solomon is so wise, he builds the temple and sins. He marries more wives than he should. He has one wife who especially captures his heart, the daughter of Pharaoh. And although she converts to Judaism, her conversion is insincere, and she continues her pagan ways. And God is very upset with Solomon for his sins, And God decrees that the kingdom will be divided. And so when Solomon passes away, his nemesis is Yerovam ben Nevat, a tremendous tzaddik. In his heyday, he was even greater than King David. But then, Ahiyah Shiloni, the prophet, who was so old, he actually left Egypt with us. He was a few hundred years old. So he comes over to Yerovam ben Nevat and tells him, God says that because Solomon sinned, when he dies, you will get 10 portions, you will get 10 tribes, and 2 tribes will remain with his son, Rechavam, the son of Shlomo. You will have the majority of Judea. And so if we look at our maps on page 1 in this pamphlet we made, we can see how the tribes are divided. Throughout the north, we have the northern 10 tribes. On the east, we have Reuven, Gad, and half the tribe of Menashe. So geographically, the majority of Israel is under the northern kingdom. And when King Solomon dies, so then his son Rehoboam takes the throne. The people are upset with Rehoboam. They ask him for a reduction in taxes. Rehoboam says, no way, I'm going to be even tougher than my dad. It's a bad move. You don't start off your kingship trying to show force. You start off your kingship trying to show you're connected with the people. But God has caused this to happen, has caused Rehoboam to make this fatal error, and the people rebel. They leave Rehoboam's rule. They come under Yerovam ben Nevat. They appoint Yerovam ben Nevat as king. The king of the south is Rehoboam, the son of Shlomo. He is the king of Judea. The king of the north is Yerovam ben Nevat. Well, Rehoboam is no loser. He puts together his army. He says, no way, people are going to leave my reign. And then God tells him, sends a prophet to tell him, no, I've decreed it so. Don't go fighting. And Rehoboam is a big tzaddik. He listens. God said, no, no. So the northern 10 tribes are under Yerovam ben Nevat. Yerovam ben Nevat puts his own honor before God's honor. Yerovam is concerned that if the people go up to serve God in the temple, they will leave his reign. Rehoboam will say, you want to serve in God's temple, you got to be my people. Even if Yerovam ben Nevat ascends with them to the temple, well, a king of Judea is permitted to sit in the temple, not so for a king of Israel. So Yerovam ben Nevat says, I'm going to come up there, and next to him, I'm not going to look like any king. So Yerovam ben Nevat appoints guards that prohibit the journey up to Judea, and he sets up 2 golden calves, one in Bethel, and one in, where? Where? No, he sets up in Be'er Sheva. No, in Dun. One in the north, one in the south. No, in Dun and in Beit El. So, maybe one Be'er Sheva, one in Dun. I don't remember. I just forgot. Right. One second, I have another here. Where was it? Let's see. I forgot. See, I'm getting old. One second. One in Beit El and one in Dun. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we have one Beit El and one in Dun. So, Yerovam ben Nevat turns away from Judaism. He sets up his own religion by changing the calendar. By implementing an added month, he can cause the Jews to forget when the Jewish holidays are, because now they don't have a Jewish calendar. And so Yerovam ben Nevat really goes off the deep end religiously. And for the remainder of our history, the kings of the northern 10 tribes keep leading the Jews astray with the intent that if they're real Jews, then they feel they'll lose them. And so you have the northern 10 tribes, which are in a terrible state, and there's constant murder going on there. You don't really have a dynasty. One king's son murders the other. You have children killing their parents, their siblings. You have not so much their parents, their siblings, and you don't have a dynasty. You have generals killing the king. You have rebellions. You don't have a continuum for too long in the northern 10 tribes. In the southern 10 tribes, you have steady continuum, the Davidic dynasty. Although the northern 10 tribes have larger numbers and they have a larger area territorially, they are exiled first, many years before the southern tribes, and they're lost. They're taken out into exile. They intermarry. Some of them come back. Some of them mix back into Judea. The majority are lost. I have three opinions in Talmud exactly what happened to them. One opinion is they're lost. One opinion is they're on the other side of Sambatyon. Another opinion is they're still coming back. We're still going to see them, maybe. What?
The other side of what?
Thursday night. Thursday night. We're doing a quick overview of Jewish history. So we have a division now. Northern 10 tribes, southern 10 tribes. Northern 10 tribes are exiled. Southern tribes under Judea. We have a small sampling of the northern 10 tribes and the southern 10 tribes. And then we reach the King Menashe, who invokes paganism in the southern tribes as well. And Menashe is a murderer. And Menashe has rivers of blood flowing through Jerusalem. And God decrees that being that the people of Judea have been sinful as well, so Judea will also be exiled. And finally, we have the destruction of the temple and the exile of Judea. But we will see that with greater detail right now. Yes, Nahum.
When the kingdom split apart, did there remain only one Sanhedrin in the south and the south? And the Kohanim and the Levites, were they also spread out through the north and the south?
Thursday night. Okay, so now I want to recap what we just did. We began with... Help me, guys. What did we begin with? Creation. 10 generations to?
Noah.
10 generations to?
Abraham
is born in the year?
1948.
Very good. We descend to Egypt. We leave in the year? 2448. Right. We spend how many years in the desert?
40.
We enter Israel under the leadership of?
Yoshua
bin Nun. 7 years capturing and 7 years dividing the land. Yoshua passes away. We enter the period of the?
Judges.
That takes about 2.5 centuries, about 3 centuries, and then we have our first, who is the final judge?
Shmuel.
He anoints our first king, who is?
Shaul.
Shaul does not finish off Amalek. The king, Agag, impregnates the woman in his cell, and from there we will have Haman. Then we move on to our next king, whose name is?
David.
Elchanan, otherwise known as David. David has a son who builds the temple. His name is?
Shlomo.
Shlomo sins primarily with marrying the daughter of? Pharaoh. When his son, whose name is? Rehavam, takes the throne, the Navi, who's been around since the Exodus from Egypt, his name is? Achiah Shiloni. He tells Yeravam ben Nevat he will get the 10 tribes. Yeravam erects 2 golden calves, one in Betel and one in?
Done.
So we have the northern 10 tribes, we have the south. The northern 10 tribes are shifted in the direction of paganism. After a few centuries, the northern 10 tribes are exiled. The tremendously sinful king of the south is known as Menashe. And then Menashe's son is very pious, Chizkiyahu. He could have been the Messiah, but didn't work out right. Had he done things right, he would have been the Messiah. But it was not to be. We move forward. We're going to start what's called the 24th chapter of Kings. Are we ready? Okay. Okay. You guys with me? We're going to run through the end of Kings. So Kings A and Kings B is a Christian invention. We have one Kings, but for some reason they printed it like the Christians. Samuel A, Samuel B is a Christian invention. We have one Samuel. Chronicles A, Chronicles B, Christian invention. Division of the book of Ezra into Ezra, Nehemiah, Christian invention. These are not our tradition, but somehow we got our Tanakhs printed that way. Okay, all these chapters are Christian inventions. Our Tanakhs don't have these chapters, but somehow the printers did it this way. Okay, so Yoyakim is 25 years old. He's going to be king for 11 years. V'yasara b'nei Hashem, he did what's evil in the eyes of Hashem. B'yamav ala Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel. Okay, pause. On his days, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, ascended on Jerusalem. V'hilo Yoyakim hevet shalosh shanim. Yoyakim became subservient to him for 3 years. V'yashu v'yimrod bo, and then he rebelled again. V'yishalach Hashem bo, et gedudei kastim, et gedudei aram, et gedudei moab, et gedudei bnei amon. V'yishalchem Yehuda l'avido. So, all these different troops came to destroy Judea, ki dvar Hashem shel diber b'yad avadav hanavim, as God had prophesied at the hands of the prophets, that he would exile Judea. Okay. So let's begin our story again. We have the northern 10 tribes. And they are exiled by which empire? The Assyrian Empire. Does anyone know what the name of the Assyrian king is? Sanherib. Sanherib is the Assyrian king. In his army, he has a midget. Very powerful, brilliant warrior, but he's a midget. He's this high. His name is Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar, just like Pharaoh was a midget, Nebuchadnezzar is a midget. So you ask me, how do I know?
It's a magician?
Midget. Not very short. Very small. How do I know Nebuchadnezzar was short? It's a good question. It's written in the Machzor Vitri. Rashi had a student named Rabbi Simcha from the city of Vitri, and he, in the end of his Machzor, he has all kinds of songs that we don't have the custom to sing anymore. And in one of those poems, he discusses Nebuchadnezzar, and in that poem, he discusses that Nebuchadnezzar was a midget. So they had on tradition that Nebuchadnezzar was a midget. He was one amma high, about as tall as Pharaoh. Yeah, little guy, but he was a powerful warrior. And the Midrash says that initially he was the king's scribe. And the king wrote a letter to the Judean king. And in the letter he writes from the king of Babylon to the king of Judea, with respect to your God, I write to you such and such. Now Nebuchadnezzar had a day off, so someone else wrote the letter, and they would keep a carbon copy for the king. So Nebuchadnezzar comes in the day later, and he's looking over what his substitute did, and he looks at the letter, and he says to him, "You're a dunce." So the guy says, "What did I do wrong?" So Nebuchadnezzar says, "You're talking about God, and you begin by writing from me, the king of Babylon? You begin by writing in the honor of God, from me, the king of Babylon, to you, the king of Judea. How do you begin by writing the king of Babylon before God's name? Aren't you embarrassed? Ridiculous." And he throws down the carbon copy and he asks, "Where's the messenger with this idiotic letter?" So they tell him he left. So Nebuchadnezzar leaves everything and starts running after the messenger. He says, "We can't let such a letter come out from under the king's hands." He takes one step, two steps, three steps. And in heaven, the heavens go crazy. The angels come before God and they say, "You see this Assyrian? You see his Babylonian? Look at how much respect he has for you, God." So the angels that are fighting for Israel clamber down and get in Nebuchadnezzar's way. And after 3 footsteps, they find ways to stop him. Because we have on tradition that had he continued running, he would have ruled the world. There'd be no claim to our defense because he had such respect for God. But for those 3 footsteps that he managed to get in before our angels got in his way, he was granted to rule the world and destroy the temple. In heaven they said, "Look at him, such respect." So that's why we take 3 steps every Shmona Esrei. You ever notice we take 3 steps towards Hashem? It's as if we're saying, "Hey, we're also taking 3 steps. Technically, on Shmona Esrei, you don't have to take 3 steps back before Shmona Esrei. You're supposed to take 3 steps forward. But very often in front of you, there's a wall, there's a table. So you take 3 steps back in order to facilitate taking 3 steps forward. The idea is, when you're coming to daven, you take 3 steps forward into davening. When you finish davening, you ask respects, you take 3 steps back. Today, people get it all backwards. They come to daven Shmona Esrei, the guy is right behind them, there's a table behind them, they shove everyone, take 3 steps back, in order to take 3 steps forward. No. Really, into Shmona Esrei, take 3 steps forward. You finish Shmona Esrei, take 3 steps back. So we also have the custom that after you took your 3 steps back, you finished your Shmona Esrei, and then the Chazan reaches Kedusha, you're going to join in his Kedusha, so you step back to your place to say the Kedusha. But really, you're not supposed to go back. You just said, "Thank you, God. You gave your respects and took your steps out of prayer." It's pretty silly to take 3 steps back, say Yosei Shalom Bimromav, and then walk right back in. You just left. What you walking back in for? Right? So the idea is you take 3 steps into Shmoneh Esrei, 3 steps out of Shmoneh Esrei. We have an interesting tradition about these 3 steps. We're taught that when Moshe saw the burning bush, he took 3 steps in the direction of the burning bush. So 3 steps have a big weight in our history. But at any rate, coming back, right? We do this at the end of Shmoneh Esrei, us Ashkenazim. Why? Because when Moshe saw the burning bush, he did this too. He said, I can't look. He covered his face. All kinds of things we do to replicate different things in history. But at any rate...
I thought it was putting your head down in shade.
No. Back to... I never heard of that one. You know, there are things I haven't heard of. If you have a source, teach me. I'm happy to learn.
That's what I thought it said in this
evening. So show me.
Oh, you say that for...
Says in shame?
Yeah, it's not just me.
Says in shame?
Yeah,
really?
I thought it was because it's used to... Like the Baladim, they prostrate on the ground like that.
No, it does say that in the art scroll. It says, in the presence of a Torah scroll, the following, until instantly shamed, is recited with the head resting on the left arm.
Can I see? Can I see? Yeah, okay. Sorry. Yeah. He's right.
That's probably the first time I've ever asked him.
No. He's right.
He's right.
Not them.
I'm wrong.
I don't mind saying he's right. I can be wrong. I'm wrong very often. Many times a day. I'm not saying I'm not wrong. I'm wrong numerous times a day. But on this one, I'm not. I don't think I'm wrong. Look, if you have a source other than that, over there, all it's saying is the words, the final words where you have your head down is Yevoshu Roga.
No,
which means...
That's just when I saw it. Okay. I wrote the Tachman and said, I just see how it's in
the
shame.
It's not out of shame. Yeah. Right. So, one understanding in that, there are a few interpretations as to why we do that. One interpretation is, we've just davened standing. Now we're going to daven bent down. Then you finish that, Yevoshu Roga, they should be instantly shamed, and you sit up straight. And then you've taken every possible position in prayer, and then you say, "Vanachnu lo nidam manaseh." God, I don't know what else to do. I've davened every way I know how.
Okay.
So I davened this way, I davened that way. Okay, back to our story. Right, Reuven's in suspense. So Sanherib comes with this massive force and exiles the northern 10 tribes. We're going to skip the details of the story. It's a very exciting story, which we will study next semester, God willing. Exactly what happens next. But to make a long story really short, he comes to the gates of Jerusalem, and he has a siege on Jerusalem. And he not only has a siege on Jerusalem, as we will see, God willing, this coming Friday in our Isaiah class, he has on his side the high priest known as Shevna Asher Ala Bait. The high priest, his name is Shevna, and politically, Shevna has swayed the majority of the Jews inside Jerusalem against the pious King Chizkiyahu to give Jerusalem into the hands of the Assyrian king. So they're standing outside the gate. The King Chizkiyahu sees that politically he's undone. The majority has sided with Shevna, and it seems like everything's over. And it's so powerful that Shevna sends word to Sanherib, tomorrow I'm bringing you the majority of the troops outside the gates of Jerusalem, and you will be able to march in and conquer Jerusalem. And when he goes out of Jerusalem, God has something unusual happen. The gates close shut behind him and lock, and no one can open them. And they're fighting with the lock. They can't get the gates open. And Shevna's standing outside and everyone else is inside. And Friday we'll discuss what happens to Shevna. But Chizkiyahu sends word to the prophet, to the prophetess, what are we supposed to do? We're done in. And God says, don't worry, it's going to be okay. And that night... an angel comes and kills out the whole camp of Sanherib. There's a plague, and they all wake up half dead, except for one man. There's one little midget who's watching as he sees an angel killing everyone all around him, and he runs away alive. He sees everyone else dying, and with this, the Assyrian Empire is done for, and he sets up his own empire, and goes and captures the capital of Assyria, known as the city of Nineveh. Nineveh is the capital of the Assyrian Empire. So now Nebuchadnezzar takes a throne and he builds up the Babylonian Empire, sets up a Babylonian army, conquers the Assyrian Empire, which is pretty easy taking after they lost over 500,000 soldiers at the gates of Jerusalem. And with that begins his Babylonian Empire. The first year of his reign, he takes down the whole Assyrian Empire. The second year of his reign, he comes back to Jerusalem. Interesting thing. After what he saw, he still comes back. And that's where we're up to here. The second year of his reign, the Judean king is the young king, Yoyakim. Ben 25 shana Yoyakim b'molcho. Va'achatesre shana malach b'Yerushalayim. He was king for 11 years in Jerusalem. V'shem imoz v'dabat p'daya min ruma v'yasra b'nei Hashem. It was in his days that Nebuchadnezzar ascended upon Jerusalem. Yoyakim says to Nebuchadnezzar, I can't. Whatever you want. For 3 years, he's under Nebuchadnezzar. And then he rebels again. And then, as we saw, so Yoyakim is subservient to him for 3 years. Okay. Now, we have to make a slight correction. The way you read the verses doesn't exactly work, because when you open the book of Jeremiah, you discover that Nebuchadnezzar only ascended to the throne in the fourth year of Yoyakim. So that doesn't work, the story I just drew. So our sages have to work out the details. And our sages tell us that the truth is that Nebuchadnezzar only ascended to the throne in the fourth year of Yoyakim, as it says in Jeremiah. So what does it mean, the third year of Yoyakim's reign? It means that Yoyakim was subservient. Remember, in the fourth year of Yoyakim, that's when Nebuchadnezzar became king. In the fifth year of Yoyakim, we said his first year, he took down Nineveh. His second year, he came and reconquered Jerusalem. And then we said Yoyakim was subservient to him for 3 years. So that's that brings us to the eighth year of Yoyakim, which is which year of Nebuchadnezzar?
Fourth.
And then Yoyakim rebelled against him. He spent 3 years in rebellion. So that brings us to the 11th year of Yoyakim, which is the 7th year of Nebuchadnezzar. And then Nebuchadnezzar came back. He said, I've had it with you. And in the 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar, which is the final year, the 11th year of Yoyakim, he retakes Jerusalem and takes Yoyakim into captivity. And
isn't that the 12th year?
No, so that was the third year, not the fourth year. The third year of the rebellion, he came and took him down, which was the 8th year of Yoyakim, the 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar, the 11th year of Yoyakim. And he takes him into captivity, takes him into Babylon, which is where Yoyakim will die. So then, let's just see a little bit more, and the rest we'll pick up with next time. So Yoyakim appoints Nebuchadnezzar appoints Yehoyachin, who was Yoyakim's son, as king instead of him. And we'll get back to this later. No, we have to discuss it now. Okay. After Nebuchadnezzar appoints his son Yoyachin. Instead, he comes back to Babylon, and all his advisors tell him, from a bad dog, you don't get a good pup. If the father, Yoyakim, rebelled against you, after you had a peace treaty with him, you can't trust his son Yoyachin. You can't leave his son on the throne. So what Nebuchadnezzar does is he comes back to Jerusalem, and Yoyachin says, hey, what did I do? He comes out, and Nebuchadnezzar takes him and his mother and his servants into captivity. And he takes the wealth of Jerusalem into captivity. But he doesn't only take the wealth of Jerusalem. He says, I want to ensure that the Jews in Jerusalem won't rebel against me. So he takes with all the wealth he takes out of the temple and the palace. It says he took all the brave soldiers, 10,000 men, and he took all the blacksmiths and all the locksmiths. Hacharash, the blacksmiths, Vamasger, and the locksmiths. So he only left the pitiful people who had simple jobs plowing the field, he left them in Jerusalem. His thought was, if I take the leaders and I take the warriors and I take the people who could actually make weapons, so then they won't rebel against me again. And he takes out Jehoiachin into captivity with all these people. And he appoints the uncle, Mataniah, as king, and he changes his name to Tzidkiyahu. Righteousness is with God between us. He changes his name from Matanya to Tzidkiyahu. And he tells him, Nebuchadnezzar, changing someone's name was a sign of ownership. And he tells him, you promise me you won't rebel. And God, who I've changed your name to incorporate his name in yours, will judge between us if you rebel. Our tradition is that when he took out Jehoiachin with all the locksmiths and blacksmiths, he wasn't really taking locksmiths and blacksmiths. That's a code. He was really taking all the rabbis. He was taking all the people who were learned in Judaism into exile. And his thought was, if I take out all the leadership and all the people who give them drive and guidance out of Jerusalem, so then they won't rebel against me. They'll remain a good colony and I'll benefit and they'll benefit. In fact, he was doing us a big favor, because we're going to learn as we continue Daniel that it didn't work. Tzidkiyahu will turn on his word. He will also rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. And that's why we're going to get a reputation as a rebellious people. And that's why Ahasuerus will view us as a huge threat, because our history will have proven that every time we were trusted with autonomy, we used it to rebel against the king who granted us that autonomy. So what happens now is all of the Jewish leadership is taken out into Babylon. The rabbis and the other leaders are taken into Babylon, and they're not sold into slavery. They're taken in as citizens. So what's going to happen is we're going to have a decade in Babylon where all the leaders are there to set up shuls and academies. And when the remnants will be exiled into slavery, you're going to have a thriving Jewish community in Babylon that will act very quickly to try and buy back their brethren and incorporate them into the communities. And this exile, which seems like a catastrophe, is really God taking care of us and ensuring that when we will be exiled into Babylon, we will have the religious infrastructure set up so that we are exiled into a territory that's already suffused with Torah. And leadership is there already. So our story begins here, with Nebuchadnezzar, out of frustration, exiling the king Jehoiachin with all the leaders. And obviously his main focus is the tribe of Judea. This is Judean territory. And that's where our story begins, the beginning of the book of Daniel. Yes, Benny.
Before, when you talk about how often we rebel, does that have any significance with did the astrologers foresee that in Egypt, that we're like the rebellious people?
Don't know. So let's begin the book of Daniel. You guys want me to read with the trup like we do on Fridays? How many people want me to read with the tune? Okay.
Is it a special one just for this book?
No.
Why is this book in Aramaic?
I don't know. But maybe I do. We'll see as we continue. First answer is I don't know. Maybe as we continue, we'll get back to it. Bishnat shalosh lemalchut Yoyakim melech Yehuda. It was the third year of Yehoyakim, the king of Judea. Now that doesn't work because we're going to read how Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem. He didn't come in the third year of Yehoyakim. Right? He wasn't king yet. It was the third year of his rebellion. He only became king in the fourth year of Yehoyakim, remember? So our tradition is that this verse really means it was the third year of Yehoyakim's rebellion. Bishnat shalosh lemalchut Yehoyakim melech Yehuda ba Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel Yerushalayim vayatzar aleha. So Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and lay siege on it. Vayitein Adonai biyado et Yehoyakim melech Yehuda. And God gave Yehoyakim, the king of Judea, into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. And this is one of the great benefits of learning Tanakh. The Tanakh teaches us perspective. You could look at our issue with the Palestinians and say, ooh, if I were prime minister, things would be better. If only the prime minister would do this, things would be resolved. And one of the things we're supposed to learn from Tanakh is to gain perspective. If we're having issues with the Palestinians, so there are two factors here. There's a problem with the Palestinians, but the root of it is that obviously we're not on a level where we deserve to have a problem-free country. So yes, we have to deal with the problem, but we also have to deal with the root of the problem, which is where we're holding. Both are true. I mean, we do have to deal with the problem. You can't just say, well, we don't need an army, we'll just do tshuva. It doesn't work that way. You need an army too. But you also have to look at the root of things, and that's what the Navi tells you. Yes, Yehoyakim lost to the king of Babylon. It was God's doing. Umiktzat kelei veit ha'elohim. He took from the vessels of the temple. He took them out with Yehoyakim. Vayviyem eretz shinar beit elohav. He brought them to the land of Shinar, which is a nickname for the land of Babylon. And he brought them to his church, the house of his pagan worship. He brought them out to Babylon. Ve'takelim evi beit otzar elohav. And then he took the vessels and put them in the treasury of his church. Vayomer ha-melech l'Ashpenaz, Rav Sarisav. And then the king said to Ashpenaz, who was his chief eunuch. The word Saris means one who was castrated. Now, traditionally, the kings would castrate any man that would be roaming their palace, because they had their wives around the palace. So obviously, if you're going to have a noble around your palace, you have to ensure that things are legit, right? So you castrate him. Very simple. Throughout this book, we have a standing machlokes. What's going on in the book? Is the book using the word saris as a borrowed term? We're going to see the Jews, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, are called sarisim. So our tradition is that they were castrated. That it means literally. That the king Nebuchadnezzar said, I need them as counsels, I need them as advisors, I can't keep looking over their shoulders, so that's part of the price of being my advisors. And all of them were castrated, and this was a punishment that came true. Our sages discuss why that happened. That's a separate discussion. But there is an understanding. The simple reading of the text doesn't have to be understood that way. The word saris can also be a borrowed term, being that generally the king's servants were castrated, so all servants were called eunuchs, but it doesn't necessarily mean they were castrated. So this is a standing machlokas throughout the book. Which way do you want me to translate it? As eunuchs or as servants? Both opinions are true. Both opinions exist throughout the book.
Well, it's being used in the term of a king's servant.
Well, that's exactly the question, is it? Right?
The word means eunuch.
The word saris literally means eunuch, one who is castrated. But over here, that's the question. Is that what it's coming to denote? Okay, so
here,
we'll say...
Translated as,
do we know if they have any descendants to these people?
That's a good question. Obviously not, right?
Depends when they were castrated.
That's true, too.
Let's see. We'll see. They were entered into the palace as children. So, okay. Lehavi, huh?
Advisors.
Okay. Servants. Okay. Nobles. Servants. Lehavi. So the king tells Ashpenaz, his head of office. He tells him, "You bring me mi b'nei Yisrael u'mizera ha'melucha u'min ha'partimim. I want you to bring me from the Jewish people, from the family of kings, those who had positions of aristocracy, u'min ha'partimim. Don't just bring me from the royal family, the rejects. Bring me from the royal family, those that have proven themselves that they come from royal blood that was active, that had leadership, that was talented. Yeladim asher in bahem kol mum. Children who have no blemish. I want them to be beautiful kids. Vitovei marei. They need to look good. They have to be aesthetic. Umaskilim bechol chokma. They have to be intelligent with a high IQ, not only what they know, but their capacity to learn. They have to be quick to understand. They have to be clear in their speech so that they will understand what they're taught well and be able to give it over well. And children who can contain themselves. Children who are mature and have self-control. Lamod becha lamelech. So they'll be able to stand when I need them to be as my counsels. They won't come up with excuses. I have to go to the restroom, this, that, or the other thing. Ulelamedam sefer ulshon kastim. Take these children. I want you to bring them and educate them and teach them our language. So teach them how to write, teach them how to read. I want these Jewish children to get the top education. And we're going to see his intent is, if the Jews are smart, then I will be able to take from them as advisors. And this happens to be a very smart move, as we will see. For generations, the Babylonian kings will benefit from this move, this educational move. Yes?
What language was that? What language was it?
Lashon Kasdim, we'll assume it's Aramaic. Vayiman lahem ha-melech devar yom b'yomo. The king personally ordered each day these children should receive mipatbag ha-melech u'miyein mishtav, that these children should receive from the king's personal foods and the king's personal wines. Remember, in those days, you had two choices of drink. It was either water or wine. So they're getting the king's meat, the king's food, and the king's wines. Ulegadilam shanim shalosh. And they will be raised in this high academy personal training center for 3 years. Umiktzatam ya'amdu lifnei ha'melech. And at the end of 3 years, they will be summoned to stand on a steady basis in service before the king. Amongst these kids, there were children, descendants of Judea, 4 children named Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Va'azariah. God is my judge. God has granted me. I am a gift from God. God is my helper. Those are their names. We will see that Nebuchadnezzar won't like these names. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar is a pagan. Yes?
How old are they at this time?
They were probably approximately 9 years old. That's what it seems like.
Nine?
We'll see.
After
yes.
The 3 years or before the 3 years?
Before the 3 years. Vayasem lahem. Look, I don't know of a commentary that says it. exactly how old they were. We'll try to piece it together from the context. There is a discussion among the commentaries, what does the word yeled mean? Yeled, child. How old will a person be and still be called a yeled? Okay. That's a broad discussion. But okay, let's see. So you got to figure, until 5 years old, a kid isn't expected to know how to read, right? At 5 years old, you teach him how to read. If he's really sharp, at four. At what age can you expect a kid not to joke around and stand around and be at attention? Not before seven, and I would say nine. So you could say back then they were mature at a younger age. But still, somewhere around there. But we'll see from the context. It seems they were about nine. We'll see. Vayasem lahem sarisim shemot. So this head of office changes their names. And we already saw that changing someone's name was a way of showing ownership. Vayasem ledaniel bel shatzar. He changed, God is my judge, he changed Daniel's name to Baal, which is the Babylonian god. They believed in a god named Baal. And Shatzar means wisdom. So he changed his name to mean the Babylonian god Baal is the one that's granting you wisdom. V'lechananyah Shadrach. He changed Hananiah's name to Shadrach, which means you're pampered and well taken care of. So, Hananya means God took care of me, right? Shadrach means you're a pampered soul. Ul Mishael Meshach. Mishael, whatever you ask him, he tells you, and it's God who gives him that wisdom. Misha, if you ask, El, he gives you an answer from God. So he changes his name to Meshach. He changes his name to you calm people down. Meshach, like Shachacha, or Meshach, you draw people with your wisdom. Vela Azariah Aved Nego. Azariah, God is my helper. He changed his name to mean Aved Nego. The servant of the Babylonian god named Nevo. So I guess in Babylonian terms, the Beis and Gimel could be interchangeable. So it could have been Aved Nevo. So he changed to Aved Nego. Now these children are sharp kids. They have a problem. They're being fed non-kosher food. So they're in prison. They could say, if we don't eat it, we'll die. But they decide they're going to try their luck. So Daniel decides, I don't want to eat this non-kosher food of the king or the wine that he's serving me. And Daniel is going to ask and see if he can get away with getting kosher food in the king's prison. The only issue is that the king personally said what he wants each kid to receive. So anyone who makes that move is at risk of losing their life. And that's the first challenge that these kids are going to have to contend with. And this is where we'll pick up, God willing, tomorrow.